From The Recount, I'm Rena Ninen, and you're listening to The Recount Daily Pod. Today's Wednesday, October 6th.
China, I think, the broad masses of the people actually support President Xi Jinping because they see a different China today, and they're asking for something to change.
That was Yukon Huang, a senior fellow in the Asia program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Yukon shares his insights into the U.S.-China relationship. We'll dig into that a little later on, but first, your morning headlines. We began in Washington, D.C., where Facebook whistleblower Frances Haugen testified before Congress on Tuesday about Facebook's harmful effects on children.
Facebook's own research is aware that children express feelings of loneliness and struggling with these things because they can't even get support from their own parents. I don't understand how Facebook can know all these things and not escalate it to someone like Congress for help and support in navigating these problems.
Haugen went on to blame founder Mark Zuckerberg, saying that by holding more than half of all voting shares, he has unilateral control over the company. She accused Zuckerberg of rejecting options to tamper down harmful content. On misinformation, she said that Facebook's over-reliance on AI to moderate content made it impossible to stop. The subcommittee chairman, Senator Richard Blumenthal, implored Zuckerberg to come to Congress and answer the accusations himself. Mark Zuckerberg addressed the allegations late last night, saying that recent coverage of Facebook, quote, doesn't reflect the company we know. Next to COVID, Johnson & Johnson officially asked federal regulators to authorize a booster shot for individuals 18 and older. The company said a booster shot taken about 2 months after the single-dose vaccine significantly boosts protection against moderate to severe disease, up to 94%. The company says studies show that the Johnson & Johnson vaccine provides longer protection when compared to Pfizer. Regulators could approve the booster as early as this month. AstraZeneca announced on Tuesday they asked the Food and Drug Administration to grant emergency authorization for long-acting antibody treatment to prevent COVID-19 in people who are at high risk of the disease. If approved, it would be the first emergency antibody treatment approved in the country. It said the treatment reduced the risk of symptomatic COVID-19 by 77%. The treatment is a therapy known as monoclonal antibodies, which introduce lab-made disease-fighting proteins into patients, usually through an infusion. And finally, we end in Switzerland, where President Joe Biden is sending White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan to meet with a senior foreign policy advisor for China. The visit is a follow-up to Biden's broad-ranging discussion with Chinese President Xi Jinping in September. The U.S. and China are still far apart on a number of issues, trade and Taiwan among them. China has recently been flexing its military muscle by flying sorties over Taiwan, a move the U.S. considers aggressive. President Xi Jinping considers Taiwan a renegade province and has vowed to reunify the island. Meanwhile, the punitive tariffs that the Trump administration put in place remain in effect. So where are U.S.-China relations headed? We dig into that with Yukon Huang, a senior fellow in the Asia program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. That's in today's Daily Deep Dive. Yukon, welcome.
Thank you. My pleasure.
So grateful to have you on. You know, you wrote this recent article for Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and you call the U.S.-China trade war a cold war. What did you mean by that?
Well, I'm saying that we began with a trade war, but it eventually evolved into a cold war. If you go back several years when Trump came into power, he saw the problem with China as really revolving around America's huge trade deficits, in the sense that America was importing much more than was exporting. And the major creditor who was generating surpluses was China. So he saw the problem in the United States as a trade deficit problem, and he saw China as the villain. But the reality is that concept doesn't make sense. First of all, trade deficits do not matter. They don't really correlate with our countries doing well or doing badly. Actually, when an economy does really well, American households and consumers import more. So it actually has a larger trade deficit. So a trade deficit is not indicative of the state of health of the American economy. The second issue is that America's been running trade deficits every year for 40 years. And it's the only country that can run trade deficits essentially forever. And the reason is that the dollar is a global currency. So Americans can borrow from abroad and others will accept the dollar. And that's not true for other countries. So the real issue is that trade is not a problem. The problem is now seen as a great power battle for technological supremacy. And there's also conflict between America's democratic system and the view of China as an authoritarian regime.
You know, you mentioned the trade is not a problem. Here's one statistic that stood out to me as we were researching this interview. Foreign investment inflow into China grew 4.5% from 2019. It hit a record $144 billion in 2020. There's little sign that these U.S. multinationals have embraced this idea of decoupling from China. How does that exactly affect the U.S. economy?
Well, trade flows, investment flows are essentially determined by business firms. It's very hard for government policies actually to affect that flow. So despite the fact that the Trump administration and the Biden administration have been discouraging U.S. companies from investing in China and trying to reduce the financial flows, portfolio flows from mutual funds into China, they in fact have surged over the past several months. China has become the largest recipient of foreign direct investment last year. Why is that? That is because China is still growing at 6 or 7% a year. Its market's expanding. It's generating huge trade surpluses. And one reason is that it took rather draconian measures to restore stability in terms of production in China. It's therefore capable of responding to the global demand for more medical equipment, supplies, communications, iPhones, automobile parts. And China's surpluses have surged. And as a consequence, of course, more money is flowing into China.
U.S. tariffs on Chinese exports under President Trump's administration jumped sixfold. That was between 2018 and 2020, covering nearly two-thirds of Chinese exports. Many of those tariffs are actually still in place. What exactly was the Trump administration trying to accomplish here, and were they successful?
Well, Trump began a trade war by levying punitive tariffs on Chinese products. Eventually, most of Chinese products coming into the United States are subject to a tariff. And the concept was that this would make Chinese goods more expensive. And as a consequence, this would reduce America's trade deficit with China. But the reality has been far different. Today, 3 years later, the trade deficit has only gotten larger. Imports from China have actually gotten bigger compared to what it was 3 years ago. So the tariffs didn't really work. Why didn't they work? Well, in some sense, China still has remained the most efficient producer of many of these consumer goods. The second issue, many of the inputs that are needed for production here in the United States, they're also produced in China. So tariffs have created a problem because many American producers have argued that the tariffs have backfired, made it more costly for American firms to compete, and therefore America's ability to export has been impeded. So most economists have concluded that the tariffs have actually been counterproductive, and the business community is asking the Biden administration to reduce these tariffs. But there's been so far no response from the administration.
If you were advising President Biden right now about the relationship with China, what would you outline to him as important to do in the coming months?
Well, I would basically say that your relationship with China depends upon economic factors and how you view them. And of course, they're affected by political considerations. And the real problem of American firms is they want better access. So the real economic issue between America and China is opening up the Chinese market so American businesses can actually invest, produce more, earn more. But the concern here in the United States is the opposite. American political system wants to decouple. It doesn't want American firms to be investing and producing in China. So I think there's a major disconnect between what I would call the political sentiments about moving away from China and the business community, which sees China as a great economic opportunity. But there's a second concern. The second concern is, as Biden has called it, competition between America's democratic system and its potential ability to influence the global international order, and seeing China as an authoritarian regime and therefore a potential enemy. And this is driving what I call the Cold War. The question then is, if you have what I call political sentiments about fighting a Cold War, economic measures really can't address that concern. You cannot change core values by sanctions or tariffs. You basically have to figure out, how do I influence public opinion? How do I draw China into better behaviors? And I think the best way actually to influence China's behaviors in the international setting is through international institutions and trade agreements. And therefore, you try to get them to shift more and more into what I call kind of acceptable practices that we have in the West.
We'll be right back with Yukon Huang, Senior Fellow in the Asia Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. You're listening to the Recount Daily Pod. Welcome back to the Recount Daily Pod, a podcast from the Recount and iHeartRadio. I'm joined by Yukon Huang, Senior Fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. We're talking about U.S.-China trade relations. What is it that you think President Xi wants from the United States?
President Xi sees China as still a developing country. Remember, China's per capita income is only about $10,000. America's per capita income is $60,000. We are much richer, much more powerful, much more advanced technically, much more advanced in terms of our military capabilities. What Xi is basically saying is he's looking forward 2030, 2050 actually. The deadline for the Chinese political system is 2049, the 100th anniversary of the formation of the People's Republic. And what they see at that time is a vision of what I call a more prosperous and technologically and innovative economy. And when they describe more prosperous, they also have this concept of shared prosperity. So that's the vision of China.
Emerging technology has been a big bone of contention between the West and China. How's that playing out?
Well, technology, knowledge sharing is a source of growth everywhere. It's a source of growth domestically in the United States, and it's the source of growth for the world because knowledge is shared globally. And if you go back 100 years and you realize that globally growth was essentially zero, and then over the last 30, 40 years, growth globally surged. Why did that happen? Because knowledge became easier to transmit both within a country and across countries. So it's the flow of knowledge that makes all of us better in terms of higher incomes and more rapid growth of economies, whether it's in the West or it's in the developing world. If you look at research and development, that's what drives growth. What we have to actually do is try to make sure that the benefits are widely shared, that it does not create what I would call security concerns. And that's the big issue. We do not have international agreements to deal with security concerns. So if China's producing communication systems like 5G networks, and from an American perspective, there is a concern that those networks could be used for security spy purposes, and therefore decoupling is being advocated. We say the same thing about semiconductor chips. If we make available high-tech chips to China, won't this increase their military capacity, the ability to compete in terms of defense or cybersecurity concerns? We need guidelines and regulations to address this kind of a question. We don't have that right now.
Is there a pressure point that the U.S. can wield on China in this moment?
The choice so far has been either we separate and decouple, or we figure out a way to collaborate with China to try to influence and shape behaviors. And there are many critics who would argue that trying to work and collaborate with China is just not going to work. The system is too different. The values are too different. China does need good relations with the West. It cannot survive, it cannot grow without those kinds of sound, sustainable trade investment links. And that is an interesting issue because China is, in a sense, hostage to a sound and rules-based international system. And the issue then is, can the United States influence and use that system to try to influence China's behavior in areas where there's a concern here? And I think that's the tricky issue. So does that mean we should work with WTO, the World Trade Organization, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, UNIDO, WHO, and in the process, try to gauge or ask China to change those kinds of behaviors which we find here in the United States objectionable? So that's the path. One path is to decouple, separate. The other path is to strengthen international understandings and rules and regulations so that there is what I call more engagement between U.S. and China to find a middle ground. And that, I think, is the challenge.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Yukon Huang, Senior Fellow in the Asia Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. You're listening to the Recount Daily Pod. Welcome back to the Recount Daily Pod, podcast from the Recount and iHeartRadio. I'm here with Yukon Huang. He's a senior fellow in the Asia program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and we're talking about U.S.-China trade relations. You mentioned finding that middle ground. China's an authoritarian state. It spies on its own citizens. That technology is now ubiquitous. Can that middle ground be found?
This is an issue that cannot be resolved in the next year or maybe the next 5-10 years. It's a generational question. If you go back 25-30 years and you look at China then, compare China now, China's much more an open system today than it was back then. And it's more open because of the engagement, the flow of ideas, the people, the trade, the context. We're going through a fairly difficult period today because President Xi Jinping has taken what I call a more aggressive posture in the foreign policy arena. And its tensions have rattled up because of Hong Kong, concerns about human rights violations in Xinjiang among the Uyghurs. There's concerns about the future of Taiwan. These are creating stress points. And there is a difficulty addressing these because they cannot be resolved very, very quickly. The question then is, what about 5, 10, 15 years? Are we going to be moving to an area where it's going to be easier or harder? My personal view is a maturing China where there's more contact and there's more availabilities, there will be a better opportunities to move toward what I call a middle ground where some of these concerns can be addressed. China is not a small country. It has a history of dealing with the West, which creates a lot of animosities. This cannot be dealt with very, very simply. The issue is, do you create frameworks for that kind of discussion and movement, or you basically separate the two? My personal view is this can be resolved, but not in the short term. It's going to take 10 years, maybe a generation.
I want to ask you, before you go, as you step back, and from what I'm hearing in this conversation, is you're saying decoupling could hurt the U.S. more than China. So if there was one thing that the Biden administration could do over the course of the next year, what is it?
Well, from a Chinese perspective, what they object to are policy measures which are directly hitting China. Tariffs hit China, restricting U.S. exports of high-tech products to China, sanctions against Chinese officials. China retaliates by sanctioning U.S. officials. So you get into this tit-or-tat issue. But here's the major concern. If we perceive of a human rights violation in terms of a Hong Kong, and therefore we close consulates or we sanction Chinese officials because we object to it, that is seen from our Beijing side as interference. Suppose the Chinese feel that America has not been dealing with the racial issues sensibly, and they see that as a human rights violation in the United States. Suppose they then said, I'm going to sanction the U.S. political leaders because of this. We would find that kind of nonsensical because we would say, what business is it of yours to censor my political leadership for policies that are seen as American issues? But that is what we're doing with China. We see them dealing with these issues in Hong Kong or Xinjiang or Taiwan, and we basically throw up punitive tariffs or restrictions, or we censor Chinese officials because we think that behavior is inappropriate. And that is the nature of what I call the unequal relationship. That is what China objects to. The relationship is not equal. So from a China view, when they're saying you are actually sort of like pursuing policies not on an equal basis, and the answer is that 20 years ago, 30 years ago, China was so insignificant in a global sense that this is not an issue. But today, that feeling has changed. So this is why China, I think, the broad masses of the people actually support President Xi Jinping, because they see a different China today, and they're asking for something to change. When Xi Jinping came into power more than a decade ago, he basically proposed as what he called a new type of great power relations. The official response from an American perspective was, we do not accept that there is a change in the power relationship. But the reality is that there is a change, but we have not formally recognized it.
Yukon, I want to thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
And now to the look ahead. Here's what else we're watching today. Texas Governor Greg Abbott, along with 8 other Republican governors, are holding a press conference this afternoon along the Texas-Mexico border to discuss what they call a crisis. The governors plan to announce a push for a new state border security plan. Extended droughts in the West are finally getting attention from lawmakers in Washington, D.C. The Senate Water and Power Subcommittee will hold a hearing this afternoon examining the status and management of the water shortages. Game, set, match. Today marks the beginning of the Indian Wells tennis tournament in Indian Wells, California. U.S. Open champions Daniil Medvedev and Emma Raducanu are headlining the tournament, taking place in the fall for the very first time. One frequent competitor who will be missing this year, Naomi Osaka. Osaka pulled out of the tournament in September to concentrate on her mental health. Have a great day. See you back tomorrow. This is a Recount Daily Pod, a podcast from The Recount and iHeartRadio. Our thanks to Yukon Huang, a senior fellow in the Asia program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, for being on the show. And if you like this episode, I hope you subscribe to The Recount Daily Pod and do leave us a rating on the Apple Podcast app. I'm your host, Rena Ninen.